You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we've got you covered for new holiday movie releases, picks for hits you may have missed this year, and favorites to win in next month's Golden Globes and Critics' Choice Awards. It's our 2023 wrap with Reggie, the real critic. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Steve Gotcher with a story about a holiday tradition that kicked off this weekend.
Posadas are an important part of Mexican Christmas tradition. These community celebrations take place on each of the 9 nights leading up to Christmas. The word posada means inn or shelter in Spanish. And in this tradition, Mary and Joseph's journey to Bethlehem and their search for a place to stay is reenacted. Angeli Soria grew up in Mexico, but now calls Milwaukee home. During a storytelling event hosted by Milwaukee's Ex Fabula, she described posadas in Mexico as a community event. But things changed when she came to the Midwest. In this edited version of her story, you'll hear Soria, as well as Megan McGee, Ex Fabula's executive director, translating.
It was when I came to the U.S. I came here in summer. On like the 10th of December, I didn't see anybody moving around on our block. And so I said to my mom, nothing's going on here. These people are really, like, boring. Yeah, why is everyone so calm? Why isn't there something going on?
So, in el día 16, que yo esperaba que hubiera posada.
So, on the 16th, when I figured, you know, there should be a posada going on,
salí a la calle y...
I went out to the street and I yelled, "This is a lie! There's nobody out here!"
Salgan!
Come on out!
Y yo gritando y tocando en algunas puertas.
And I was screaming and like knocking on doors.
Y alguien llamó a la policía.
Somebody called the police.
Yo estaba ahí parada, pues nadie salía y...
I was just there standing, like, nobody's coming out.
Me dijeron, me preguntaron, ¿qué haces tú aquí? Alguien dice que tú estás haciendo escándalo.
And they asked me, like, what are you doing here? Someone says that you're causing trouble.
Y yo le dije, bueno, sí, yo estaba preguntando a voz alta por qué nadie salía si era el día de las posadas.
Well, and I was just asking very loudly why no one was out here doing posadas.
Y me dijo, oh, ¿tú eres mexicana?
And they said, oh, you're Mexican?
Dije, sí, yeah. Pero también hay otros que no son mexicanos.
And I said, yes, but there's other people that aren't Mexican.
Dice, that's okay. Aquí es diferente, es quiet.
That's okay. Here it's different. It's very quiet during posadas.
Ve a una iglesia.
And he said, go to a church.
Allí vas a encontrar posada.
There you're going to find the posadas.
Y aún estando yo aquí... Anhelo tener ese tiempo que yo tuve allá.
And even though I'm here, you know, I remember what I had there. I remember those posadas.
Porque es mi cultura.
It's my culture.
Es algo con lo que crecí.
It's something I grew up with.
Y que al llegar a este país, lo rompí.
And when I came to this country, that tradition broke.
Y la razón es que se rompe es porque se acaba tu tradición. Y no es que tú... lo inicies es porque te estás adaptando a una nueva cultura.
And the reason that these traditions break, it's not that you like deliberately break it, but it's that you're adapting to another culture.
Y invitas amigos.
Maybe you invite friends.
Y conocen
over.
Tu cultura, tu tradición.
And they get to know your traditions, your culture.
Y algunas personas les gusta.
And some people love it.
La prueba está que ahora, no importando la raza, quebran piñatas.
You know, now, no matter what ethnicity or racial background you have, people are breaking piñatas.
En los cumpleaños.
Yeah.
Cumpleaños.
Yes.
Sí. Thank you for listening to me.
Mil gracias, eh?
Thanks to our friends at Ex Fabula, Milwaukee's very own storytelling and community building program, for sharing this story with us. You can hear the full story online at wisconsinlife.org. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Steve Gotcher.
Now, the holidays are always a chance to check out a few big-name movie releases or catch up on films from the past year that you finally have a few extra hours or maybe days to catch up on, streaming or if they're still in the theaters. Plus, we can look ahead to next year's fast-approaching awards season and get some nostalgia with a classic or two. Reggie the Real Critic is back with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What were your favorite movies of 2023? Are there ones you have plans to see over the next couple few weeks? Or do you need some advice from Reggie on what to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Reggie Ponder is resident critic for Vocalo Radio in Chicago and Garfield Lawndale Voice Chicago. He's a member of the Critics' Choice Association. You can find him on the social medias at The Real Critic. That's R-E-E-L-L, Critic. Reggie, welcome back.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm glad to be back, and it's been a whirlwind since the strike has been over. Everybody's trying to promote their movies, and It's been a bit, so I'll tell you that much.
Well, let's get going into the movies now. We've got a couple of remakes, basically, that I'm seeing a lot of the ads for. Let's start with one, Wonka, now with Timothy Chalamet, yet another go at Willy Wonka. Here's a clip of the title character talking to the young actress Calla Lane, playing Wonka's assistant, Noodle.
What are you doing?
I'm making chocolate, of course. How do you like it?
I don't know. I've never had any.
You've never had chocolate?
Still no.
Well, lucky for you, Noodle, I have a selection of the world's finest ingredients right here in my travel factory.
Whoa.
Where to begin? That's the question. I know. Silver linings, made of condensed thunderclouds and liquid sunlight.
Did you always want to make chocolate?
No. Back when I was your age, I wanted to be a magician. Here, try one.
Reggie Wonka has divided the Central Time team. We have one big dislike and one moderate like. Your thoughts on the new Wonka movie?
Wow. I like this. I thought it was imaginative. It was a different take. And I think it's absolutely going to resonate with people of all ages, actually. I think kids of all ages. Wow, people didn't like it? I like this.
Well, I don't want to name names, but executive producer Dean Knetter was a big no on this one. Oh, I named the name. Darn it. Here's another. Oh, go ahead. Yeah, make the case for people who aren't, you know, Grinches that they might like this Wonka movie.
Yeah. I think what they did here is that they had this young guy who set out to the big city to try to realize his dreams. And this is a realize your dreams movie. And I think that it'll resonate with a lot of people. And if you don't leave, I'd ask Dean, did he at least leave wanting some chocolate? And if you did, it did its job.
Dean came in wanting chocolate. That's an easy one. Here's another remake coming out now. Christmas Day, this is coming up. 1985's The Color Purple, adapted from Alice Walker's novel. Want to give a listen to Oprah Winfrey, a producer on the film. She sets up a little clip here, too, I think.
There's nothing that's been more important or vital to me culturally, artistically, than The Color Purple. It is a solid base of spiritual and emotional power for me. Every woman and man who has been invisible, who has felt unseen and unvalued, this is their story.
Today, our teacher taught us about a place called Africa. Our mamas come from Queens over there. You know what that means? We? Royalty.
It's Oprah there, and then actress Halle Bailey in the movie itself. A remake of Color Purple. Reggie, what do you think? Why now, and are you looking forward to this one?
So it's not a remake. It's a
totally re-adaptation.
And the reason it's not a remake, though, is that the musical wasn't a remake. It was a different look at this at the book. And what they did here is they really pulled from the musical and added some things. This has more it's giving the characters more imagination, and it's going into it goes a little bit deeper into some of the themes for the movie. So if you had to ask Blitz, who was the writer director, he would say it's not a remake, and Oprah definitely would say it's not a remake. So I want to put that out there.
I don't want Oprah mad at me, Reggie. So thank you.
Oh man, you don't want Oprah mad at you. I'm gonna tell you, I did not want to see another version of this movie because I felt that the classic was the classic. And after seeing the movie, I went out to LA to see it. This is a Herculean achievement. It will make you say that they own this. It's all like singing a Dionne Warwick song and owning it, and people forgetting that it was a Dionne Warwick song. This was done really, really well. The actors, I got a chance to interview Taraji P. Henson, Fantasia, and Danielle, and they really put their heart into this. This is a must-see movie. I encourage people to check this one out over the holidays. You will cry, but you will come out uplifted as well.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Tim is with us in Viroqua. Tim, what movie is on your mind?
Well, it's Napoleon, and I'm interested in what your guest review of that movie is. My review is Napoleon, the movie, ironically, would have been better were it shorter.
Thanks a lot for that capsule review, Tim. Reggie, have you seen this one?
Yeah, I think that Hollywood is getting carried away with these movies that are long movies, and I can't disagree with that at all. Is that how do you need 30, 40 more minutes to tell that story? Could you condense it down? Some of these movies, including, we'll get into movies like Oppenheimer and Killers of the Flower Moon, these movies get to be pretty darn long. And I'm going to tell you, at my age, I'm going to need a bathroom break.
Tim, thanks a lot for that call. Hey, let's get into some of the, award fodder. You know, half of Barbenheimer is up for a lot. Barbie is actually up for some the comedy category, I think, in the Golden Globes, or I can't remember which one. Your thoughts on some of the top contenders around award season now?
Yeah. So looking at what has been nominated so far from the AFI, the Golden Globes, and the Critics' Choice Awards, which I'm a member of, there are seven movies that stand out that everybody kind of agrees that are the top of the heap. And that's Barbie and Killers of the Flower Moon, as well as Oppenheimer. So those are really like the three front runners. What I'll say is that Barbie is probably the most different movie for Hollywood. I think Killers of the Flower Moon and Oppenheimer are the types of films from a theatrical perspective, meaning people say that these people really acted in the movie. When you look at Barbie, they might get dismissed somewhat because the lighter a film. But Barbie is going to do really, really well, I think, just across the board. There's some other movies like The Holdovers, which I would also say is a good holiday movie because we talked about holiday movies. Hopefully people will go out and see The Holdovers as well. Then there's Maestro, Past Lives, Poor Things, and American Fiction. So those are the top seven movies that are out there from the critics so far.
We'll dig into a couple of those movies coming up. We are wrapping up the year in movies with Reggie Ponder, also known as Reggie the Real Critic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a favorite movie you've seen over this last year, or one that is on your radar that you maybe need a nudge to actually go check it out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Reggie Ponder, a.k.a. The Real Critic. He's resident critic for Vocalo Radio in Chicago and Garfield Lawndale Voice Chicago. Looking at some of the best movies of 2023, new releases, maybe some award-likely candidates. You could join in with yours at 800-642-1234. If you have a movie to recommend from this year or a movie you're wondering about that's maybe just coming out or just about to come out, let us know. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. All right, I want to check out some of those other contenders. And this is a good one because it's also a new release just about to come out, I think, later this week. Tell us about American Fiction before we get to a little taste of it.
Yeah, American Fiction stars Jeffrey Wright as a professor who obviously has to write books because you have to publish. And his books are not doing that well. He goes to a conference. He finds out that There's another author, black author, who's doing really, really well. And she's doing well with a book that is he believes is nonsense. And he believes that is not literary greatness. And the question is, does he stoop to the level and start to write that kind of book? Or does he keep his morals and continue to write the types of books that he thinks he should write?
Let's give a listen to Jeffrey Wright as the author of Thelonious Ellison in American Fiction.
Excuse me, Ned, do you have any books by the writer Thelonious Ellison?
Yeah, this way. Here you go.
Right. Yeah. Wait a minute, why are these books here?
I'm not sure. I would imagine that this author, Ellison, is black.
That's me, Ellison.
Yeah.
He is me, and he and I are black.
Oh, bingo.
No bingo, Ned. These books have nothing to do with African-American studies. They're just literature. The blackest thing about this one is the ink.
I don't decide what sections the books go in, and no one here does. That's how chain stores work.
Right. Ned, you don't make the rules.
I'm just gonna put them back after you leave.
Don't you dare, Ned. Do not you dare.
All right, Reggie. Jeffrey Wright is one of those actors who's like, I always like seeing him, right? He's always good and stuff. This is a starring role for him. What do you make of American Fiction?
Yeah, this is a very provocative, a funny, a sad movie as well. It's funny in that it makes a commentary on fiction, on the literary industry. It's sad in that the commentary is pretty accurate in terms of what the industry wants to promote and push forth and how they look at black authors. But this is not a black movie. This is a movie I think that everyone should see. And it's really interesting, very, very funny, and very witty. A great job with a star cast. Leslie Uggams actually makes a star appearance. I just want to mention her, even though there are a lot of other good stars there, that Leslie Uggams doesn't get that much shine. So just want to mention that she was in this movie as well.
George on Facebook brings up the movie Maestro, and that is on your list as well as the in the award categories. Tell us a little bit about Maestro.
This film, your guy Bradley Cooper, and I'm just going to call him your guy because if he should be everybody's guy, he worked on this movie I think for 7 years, and it really chronicles the lifelong relationship of the conductor composer Leonard Bernstein and actress Felicia Montegre, and it's just a towering performance. And I will tell you, Carey Mulligan in this film as his wife she's fantastic. This is a really, really good film. I don't know if all the parts equal to the award-winning part of that, meaning it's the best film of the year, but the acting is good, the music is good, all the parts are good in this film. Good job. I think this is absolutely worth checking out.
I like Bradley Cooper in the TV show Alias. I don't know if that makes him my guy or not, though. You also mentioned, Reggie, the movie The Holdovers, and I don't feel like this one's gotten as much attention, at least not as much advertising, as some of these other big names. Tell us a little bit about The Holdovers.
So Paul Giamatti stars as this teacher, a history teacher, but he's a very, very cranky history teacher. None of the kids
wait.
Like him.
Paul Giamatti plays a cranky guy?
Yeah.
He's really stretching, man.
There you go. And none of the students like him, but he gets the short end of the draw and has to stay over with the kids who can't go home for some reason. Either their parents are not there, or they got to go overseas, or whatever. And he has to stay there with the head of the cooking department, the food service department, him and another student, and they end up learning more about each other. It is a really smart movie, and when people walk away from it, they'll see a lot of themselves in it, and they'll see individuals also revealing themselves. So Divine Joy Randolph plays the head of the food service there, And she and Paul Giamatti are really great together. And then newcomer Dominic Sessa is the student who has to stay over. And they all have some different issues. This is absolutely a holiday movie, and I think a one to see. You'll come out of it talking about it for sure.
And then, Reggie, you've got some movies that were big hits over the year, but obviously not everybody saw them. Give us a couple that we should catch up on if we missed them in 2023.
So if you miss anything, please just go make sure you see this year, It's a Wonderful Life. That's all I want to say. I just make sure you see It's a Wonderful Life, my favorite movie. So, but other blockbusters that you might want to see is that John Wick Chapter 4. You might want to see, I'm forgetting the other one that I want to tell you.
Well, you gave us a little list. One of them dealing with the complicated issue of artificial intelligence, Mission Impossible, Dead Reckoning, Part 1.
That one. And I would absolutely stream that at home. I would check that one out as well. And of course, you have those some animation films in there. But I think what most people are going to do this, and maybe you don't do this, but a lot of people are going to be watching those Christmas movies on Hallmark, Lifetime, BET, all these channels who have gotten into the Christmas business and have probably like 50 different love movies out there for you to see.
Reggie, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us again. A happy holidays and have a good new year.
Happy holidays. Thanks again.
That's Reggie Ponder, resident critic for Vocalo Radio. You can find him on social media at The Real Critic. Talk to him about the year in movies, some new releases, and his picks for January awards shows as well. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Think about the last fiction book you might have read. If you're like me, you probably remember the author's name, what the cover looked like, and, you know, some of the content of the book itself. How about the publisher? Do you know who that was? Maybe, maybe not. Chances are, if it was a work of fiction published in the last decade or so, the publisher was Penguin, Random House, Hachette, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, or Macmillan. These publishing companies are known as the Big Five. They control over 80% of the trade book market in the United States. Last year, Penguin Random House tried to purchase Simon & Schuster for over $2 billion. That merger was blocked by the government over concerns about competition. That attempted merger is part of a decades-long trend of consolidation in the publishing industry. And our next guest says it's about more than money and business decisions. In his new book, he looks at the rise of publishing giants and how that shaped what ends up on bookshelves and the reading experience itself. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you read a lot of fiction, a particular genre? If so, do you follow any particular authors, self-published or on the bookshelves or online? How do you discover new fiction? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dan Sinekin is an assistant professor of English at Emory University. His latest book is Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Dan, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here.
You trace kind of a before and after in your book with where a lot has changed in the publishing industry. Give us a taste of what the publishing industry looked like 50, 60 years ago at the outset of your book.
Sure. So in the 1950s, the publishing industry looked completely different than it does today. Back then, you had a bunch of small independent publishing houses that were run and owned by the founders or the heirs of the founders in many or most cases. That started to change in the 1960s when businesses started to consolidate the industry. And as you said in the intro, this gradually increased through the 70s, 80s, and 90s to the point where now five companies control something like 80% of the business.
And as I mentioned, your book traces, you know, what does that mean for the books that get published and what we read? But one really big point I think you try to make is there wasn't necessarily a golden age. You don't make the case that the 50s were necessarily the good old days.
That's right. There was a lot of racism in publishing. There was a lot of misogyny in publishing that I trace in those earlier days. There still is some of that today, but we've seen that decrease. So you wouldn't want to paint a picture. And I also think that we're still in a world where lots of great books get published. It's just the kinds of constraints that writers publish within today have changed, and the kind of rules of the game that determine the kind of stories that they write have changed.
And a key factor in your book is, you know, as a reader, I think of a fiction book as, you know, a thing by that author. They do this creative work. If it's good enough, gosh, they get a publishing contract. Eventually, if it's so good, I find out about it and read it and enjoy it. You really focus in on the book industry as creating commercial products, right? Things that are marketed and sold to people like you and me. Tell us a little bit about how the book world looks different through that lens.
Sure. So one of the opening moves I make in the book is to ask readers to think about the publishing company and the little symbol on the spine of the book. If you look at the spine of your book down near the bottom, you'll see a little symbol. And that symbol is sometimes called a colophon. And that is the symbol for that publishing company. And there's a whole world of people who live within that colophon, who are in that publishing industry, who helped make the book that you have. And that whole system contributes to what's in the pages of most any book. This can be kind of extreme in some cases, like the Hardy Boys or Nancy Drew, where there was a whole fiction factory called the Stratemeyer Syndicate of lots of different writers who would write those books, even though they were all published under one pseudonym to make them seem as if they were by one author. And there's lots of cases of ghostwriters or developmental editors helping out, editors doing a lot of hands-on work, literary agents really help shaping books. Even cases where people from marketing and sales have a lot of control over the kinds of books that get acquired, and thus the kind of taste that a publishing house is going to end up having in the way the books look on that list. So there's a whole world of people who end up shaping books, even I would say by some of the people we most imagine to be those autonomous authors, those romantic authors, kind of singular geniuses of American literature, like Cormac McCarthy or Toni Morrison. Even them, I think, are subject to the forces of the publishing industry.
Talking to Dan Senekin about his new book, Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an author, love to hear your experience in getting published or trying to get published. If you've worked in the book industry, love to hear your take on how things might have changed over the years. Join in at 800-642-1234. Give us a taste, Dan, of how this conglomeration, all these industry mergers, might have changed what we see on the bookshelf or the virtual bookshelf, as the case may be.
For sure. So in 2023, some of the biggest trends in books are romance. You might think of someone like Colleen Hoover, who sells just an outrageous number of books, or fantasy. Brandon Sanderson is a name of someone who sells just, again, an outrageous number of books. And in the book, I argue that the rise of fantasy and romance as popular genres in 2023 has everything to do with the conglomeration of publishing. And that really begins when conglomeration gains control over the industry in the mid to late 70s. What happened was publishing companies started to get demands from their owners for quarterly growth. They suddenly had a lot more pressures to make a profit than they did previously in a regular quarter-by-quarter profit. At the same time, the 70s was a tough time to sell books because there was bad inflation, wages were stagnating, consumers had less money to buy them. So publishers really had to figure out a way out of this pickle. One of the things they did is they followed the path that was led by a little Canadian company called Harlequin. Harlequin, of course, became known for its romance novels. And in particular, they didn't necessarily have famous novelists. They got famous as a publishing company and for writing series of books that they would pay hack writers. They wouldn't pay their authors a ton of money, so they'd be cheap to make. And then people would recognize, oh, Harlequin, I know the kind of romance books that they publish. I'm going to buy those and then get hooked on those and keep reading these series of books one after another. So other publishing companies realized that they could make money on that model, particularly in the genres of romance, which boomed in the 1980s, and fantasy, which wasn't really a mass popular genre. It wasn't a genre at all in the way we understand it until the wake of the Lord of the Rings books, which became famous only in the late 1960s. and weren't made into a genre until the late 1970s, really to kind of help publishing companies make these profits under their new owners. So the 1980s, when you started having these chain bookstores in shopping malls that were going up all over the suburbs, were ideal to sell romance and fantasy, because here you had moms shopping the shopping malls, maybe taking their kids, their tweens or young teens, and the moms would buy the romance books and the tweens would buy the fantasy books. And that world that was created by conglomeration in the 1980s is still the world of books we're living with today.
Can you talk about the change in the dominant figures in the industry? Early on, it seems like the editors had so much latitude over who they'd work with and what kind of things they'd publish and what changes then they demand. At different stages in the story you tell, it might be, you know, the buyer for Borders or Barnes & Noble. And now the gatekeepers, I'm not sure who the gatekeepers are. How has that changed over this time period?
Yeah, so people talk about the great Maxwell Perkins as this editor who had this immense power shaping the work of Thomas Wolfe and discovered Ernest Hemingway and worked with F. Scott Fitzgerald. And the story of early 20th century publishing is often told as the story of the editor and the writer working together. With the rise of conglomeration, you just start to have a lot more hands on deck and a lot more forces shaping the kinds of books that we read, much beyond just the editor and the writer. And this is in part because as the demands to sell more books and sell them more efficiently increases, the job of the editor becomes less about acquiring and editing books, especially less about editing books, and more the role of a manager overseeing the movement of that book from one part of the publishing company to another and making sure it gets published well and is successful as a commodity. So the editor has less and less time to edit, and that gets replaced by figures such as the literary agent, especially. The literary agent becomes necessary in a way that he or she wasn't before, starting in the 1970s. And the agent becomes this figure who becomes a powerful advocate for the writer, which also wasn't exactly true prior to the 1970s. They had been more a neutral mediator, but they really became an advocate for the author in the 1970s. And the agent, the literary agent, has different motives than the editor. The literary agent is paid on a commission and a percentage of how much the book sells. And so the agent is really looking out for markets, is kind of the embodiment of the invisible hand of the market, and helping guide American fiction toward a more market-oriented approach overall.
Talking to Dan Senekin, assistant professor of English at Emory University, talking about his new book. It's called Big Fiction: How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Looking at the ways that money and power in publishing have shaped the state of the fiction that comes to you at a bookstore. If you go to bookstores, on Amazon, or wherever you go to find fiction, you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you are a reader, how do you look for that next book, that next author? Are you looking for stuff that's kind of like things you've read already, or do you have ways to branch out? It can be hard to do these days, even though there's so much fiction out there. If you are a writer and have tried to publish a book by yourself or sell it to someone, love to hear your experience. Or if you're in the industry on one of those many job titles that Dan just hinted at, love to hear your perspective as well. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with professor and author Dan Senekin about his new book, Big Fiction: How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you follow certain publishers or labels because you know they print the books that you like to read? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. John is with us in Altoona. John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just read To Set a Watchman, a couple of months ago, and I was surprised how different it was from To Kill a Mockingbird. So when Harper Lee had written this, as probably a lot of people know, it was heavily, heavily edited by her publisher, and it really changed it into a completely different book. They couldn't be more different, especially some of the most tender parts of To Kill a Mockingbird that make it such a classic for kids and for people interested in basically like racial rights and things like that, were really not there in her original writing. And so I just wanted to point out that some of the work that publishers do with their authors, even though it might seem like it's pointed towards commercial success of the books, has really produced some really wonderful literature too. And to set a watchman, that was just one of the an example that came up to me.
John, thanks for the call. Dan, what do you think?
I Go Set a Watchman. I mean, it's a complicated example because some people argue that Harper Lee was very old at the time and was entering senility. And some feel as though that book was merely an earlier draft of To Kill a Mockingbird, and that in it you see Atticus Finch as less sympathetic. He is revealed as actually a bit of a racist in Go Set a Watchman, rather than the kind of champion of anti-racism that he seems to be in To Kill a Mockingbird. But it was a book that had an immense, I mean, everyone wanted to buy and read that book. I bought it the day it came out. I was myself disappointed with it, but it sold an incredible amount of copies. And so the publisher had great financial incentives to sell that book. And, you know, some people like the reader might think that the editing on the book was strong and made it a good book. My own opinion is that it probably would have been better to keep that one in the archives.
John, thanks for calling. I think John was saying, if I'm not mistaken, the editing on the To Kill a Mockingbird was good.
Yeah. No, the editing on the To Kill a Mockingbird, you can see the way that the movement from the earlier draft and go. Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Thank you. The earlier draft of Go Set a Watchman is just much less of a book than To Kill a Mockingbird. So you see that the way the editor helped develop that book in To Kill a Mockingbird was instrumental in making the classic. Yes, thank you.
And then John's point about that collaborative model. I mean, you mentioned earlier Cormac McCarthy. You read also in the book about David Foster Wallace. I think two authors who people think of as having a really unique voice, accurately, I think that's fair to say, but that there was a fairly long and involved and in some cases contentious collaborative process with their publishers to make them have a chance at commercial success too.
Yeah, but both are absolutely fascinating instances, the careers of both David Foster Wallace and Cormac McCarthy. And you really see, after you explore, like I did, their archives and their relationships with their publishers and their agents and their editors, the way in which the relationship with their publishers deeply shaped the kind of work they did. In the case of Cormac McCarthy, you have him writing the first half of his career from the early 1960s through the 1980s, really under the guidance and the care of an editor named Albert Erskine, who was an editor of the old school. He was actually the last editor for William Faulkner, a writer to whom McCarthy often is compared. And he protected McCarthy from conglomeration and the demands of the marketplace, allowing McCarthy to write these very strange, eccentric, difficult books that didn't sell very many copies. In fact, at one point, all five of his first novels went out of print, and he would write in letters to people in the late 80s that he had never made a single cent in royalty checks from any of his books, even though he'd been a professional writer for near 30 years. But Erskine retired in the mid to late 80s and died, and McCarthy realized he didn't know whether or not he had a future in publishing without Erskine there to help him. And so what he did is he sought out an agent. And he got a very high-powered agent. He got one of the most high-powered agents in the game. And she set him up with a new editor and a new team of folks, moving him from Random House to Knopf, which was an imprint within Random House. And this whole team really shaped a new kind of Cormac McCarthy. And he came out with a book in 1992, All the Pretty Horses, which was a different style. It was much closer to a classic Western. I kind of think of it like Louis L'Amour, but done in Cormac McCarthy's voice. It's a Western. And it sold 100,000 copies out the gate. And they made a movie with Matt Damon. It won the National Book Award, but it was a much more digestible, marketable book than his previous work. And so that's a case where you can really see the force of conglomeration on a single writer's career.
Let's go back to our callers. Cheryl is with us in Eau Claire. Cheryl, hi.
Hi there. Yes, I have several series authors that I'll always be on the lookout for a book, and I can't wait for them. I moved and I have like older books now, and I'll take them to Savers or Goodwill, but with the price of hardcover books, that plays a factor in my price, you know, purchasing of books. But certain authors, like certain actors, I'll always buy their books.
Cheryl, thanks a lot for the call. Dan, and it seems like more and more the conglomerates are looking for that franchise author, whether they're actually writing a franchise, but somebody who people like Cheryl, and Cheryl's certainly not alone, once they find that author, they go back to again and again. I look for that kind of author, too.
Oh, yeah, sure, I do, too. And that is a great way for publishers to figure out how to make their sales more predictable, is if they can make the author into a well-known brand, then they're in good shape. And one of the classic ways that they did this, starting in the late 1970s, they built out their marketing departments, which were much smaller in the 1950s and 1960s, and they invested in making authors household names. And they did this with people in the late 1970s like Stephen King or Daniel Steele, or then Tom Clancy and John Grisham, names that are still, especially Grisham, King, and Steele, are still, they're still writing and they're still at the top of our bestseller lists today. And this is something that's really often done in partnership with the publishing house, who are helping create these names so that they can have dependable sales.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Dan Senekin about his latest book, Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature. Dan, I have an acquaintance who is an author here in Wisconsin. He had a genre book that had some success. He went to his publisher and said, hey, I've got this idea for another character and another genre. And like, yeah, that's great. Or you could do a sequel with exactly the same character and their further adventures kind of thing. And that's what he ended up doing. How much pressure is there to have sequels and maybe things that can be turned into movies and blockbusters and things like that these days?
Yeah, that's a great anecdote. And it shows how sometimes the way the books that we read, there's gentle nudges from publishing houses. The incentives for them to sell books can just kind of help push a writer in one direction or another. And there's many books we could have seen in the world, like your friend's book that he didn't write, that never appear because of the way the publishing world is structured. And so, yes, there's a lot of incentives to do sequels and to do stuff that is built as a series from the outset, because if readers liked the first one, they'll keep buying the next ones.
In our last minute or so, Dan, you've covered, what, 60, 70 years of history. What trend, what development are you watching for right now?
So it's what's been really wild in the last decade are a few things. One is the immense amount of writing and reading that is done on the internet in self-publishing, fan fiction, and sites like Wattpad, where especially younger women and girls are doing an immense amount of writing fiction and reading fiction collectively in the genres of romance and fantasy especially. I'm also looking at the growth of audio. Audiobooks have become enormously popular in the last decade and are expected to continue to grow. And finally, artificial intelligence is already changing the way people, especially in self-publishing, are writing. And I think that's something we're all going to want to keep an eye on in the years to come.
Dan, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
That's Dan Senekin, assistant professor of English at Emory University. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Big Fiction, How Conglomeration Changed the Publishing Industry and American Literature, and how trends in the publishing industry shape the world of books for better sometimes and sometimes worse. You can share your favorite book franchises if you have one, if you actually follow particular publishers, or if you have a story of how you found out about a particular author that you've come to know and love, let us know. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. I'm Rob Verrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.